Hey, it's the FinTech Newscast. My name's John, and with me, as always, is Steve. How are you doing?
I am well, John. How are you?
Great, great. I'm excited because we have a great guest on this week talking about something that always gets a lot of hype. People are always interested in. Nobody knows what it really does. I'm not talking about blockchain this time. I'm talking about AI and machine learning. And we're lucky to have with us Shamik Kundu, the head of financial services for True Era. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me on the podcast. Great to be here.
Yeah, great, great. We're going to throw you a bunch of tough questions to solve what's going on with the whole financial world and AI. So just to get the question that I always have on my mind. Well, when I read about this, is what do most financial institutions get wrong about AI? I'm sure you must have some opinions on this, or what could they do better when it comes to AI?
I think that could be a very long list, but if I had to start with one
I
thing, I
agree.
think it is, if I had to start with one thing, I would say thinking of AI and as a separate thing is probably the thing that most people get wrong. Because when you start saying we're doing AI, we are using machine learning, you make it about the technology rather than what you're trying to do with it. At the end of it, first of all, AI, of course, is a very broad definition. And if you look at the European Union's regulation on AI, it covers every single kind of automated decision making. So I think it's just a very amorphous blob to talk about, firstly. And secondly, when you start talking about something that people are potentially scared about, some are skeptical about, you just get into a very wrong frame of mind. So I think perhaps the single biggest thing large financial institutions get wrong is to think of AI or machine learning as a separate thing, which creates a lot of hype around it, a lot of concerns around it, and ultimately, I dare say, holds back its adoption. So the flip side of that is the best thing financial institutions could do is to stop focusing on the AI and start focusing on the business problems, the customer problems that they're trying to solve. And then get to, okay, when we're trying to solve it with specific techniques such as machine learning, what do we need to be more cautious about? What do we need to do better?
And this is the whole reason for existence of True Era, right? It's helping build up the infrastructure and the thinking as well. Do you find yourself having to explain that to your clients?
Yes, that is what True Era exists for. We're a startup that provides software to understand, analyze, and monitor machine learning models, which, as you know, have certain quirks that make them some kinds of machine learning models. Certainly, they have quirks that make them more opaque, that make them potentially unstable with time in situations like the pandemic, and of course can accentuate bias in certain situations. So yes, that's the problem we try and help our clients to solve. To the second part of your question, do we see that in the clients I talk to? Now, the interesting thing is, of course, the clients I will personally talk to, and I have spoken to about 50 plus financial institutions around the world since joining True Era at the start of the year. These are typically chief data officers, chief analytics officers. So I think that group probably gets it, but I think part of the problem is that AI is something that everyone has a view on, or at least they think they have a view on. And I think broader organizational understanding of what AI is, what it is capable of, what it's not capable of, what things we need to be cautious about is certainly one of the areas that we often find ourselves getting involved in talking with clients.
So who do you see in the financial or fintech world that's using AI or machine learning in a smart way, or that you thought was pretty interesting?
To avoid making any of our clients unhappy, I'll probably not take names, but I will answer your question slightly indirectly. I think that the ones that have got it right, and I would say about 20% of the 50 that I talked to, and this seems to be a consistent number, even talking to consulting firms, about a fifth of the total seem to have got it right. And they're not necessarily all big firms, and they're not necessarily all fintechs either. I mean, I'm surprised at the number of, not surprised, I suppose, but one often thinks that if you're a fintech, you're likely to adopt the most updated technologies all the time. And actually, many of them don't need it, because for what they're doing, traditional technologies and can be perfectly good enough. Traditional automation can be perfectly good enough. But what I have seen interesting are the ones who take AI and machine learning to solve the problems they haven't solved before. So what I mean by that is I see two categories of use cases. There are those who are using machine learning to incrementally do what they were already doing better. And that's good. That's not a bad thing in itself. But the ones who make the most difference are those who are cracking the problems that they and their customers and their stakeholders have been struggling with for a very long time. And they're now getting over those with AI. And examples of this from a use case perspective would for example, be in insurance, where machine learning in its full form is helping them access the kinds of data that they might not have accessed in the past, whether it's satellite imagery or IoT data, et cetera. Just processing that amount of data, there is just no precedent for that inside the organization. So it's not automated underwriting, but it's actually getting better data into these underwriting and pricing models. That's an example of something that is not possible before. In banking, a lot of fraud-related work, which obviously stays in the background, would not have been possible without some of these new techniques. There's interesting pieces around, like where I sit in Asia, when you want to reach out to customers that haven't been part of the financial world, so financial inclusion in another world, you're dealing with customers with no credit bureau data, no histories, and you're using alternate data. Again, not a problem you can solve. There is no traditional model that you can build on that. So the ones who really are doing good things are the ones, or interesting things in my mind, are the ones who are attacking the problems of their customers that haven't been addressed by traditional mechanisms, rather than those who are just trying to incrementally improve what they've already been.
Staying on in the banking space, I understand that a lot of what you guys do at Terraria is also create or rather address what I call the explainability issue with AI, where you can actually, you know, if you're the client for a loan, you can tell the customer why that happened and also look at the algorithm and say who's getting approved and who's not, which is interesting. I'll give you my own experience with this. I have a pretty good credit score. I make a good salary, no debt on my cards. Yet somehow my bank denied me a credit increase on my credit card recently, but it wouldn't tell me why. And I felt that was a kind of a bad customer experience. How can a service like Terraria address those key points, understand the mechanisms and the decisions that the AI makes and why it makes it, and also sort of improve the customer experience?
I'm glad you started with the customer experience, though. I'm sorry that happened to you, but I think the key point is to start with the customer experience, right? So if you look at your particular decision, well, they didn't explain it to you. So you presumably have no idea whether that was because a human being decided something, overruling a machine, or whether it was the machine. You also don't know whether it was a machine learning kind of, let's call it an AI model, or whether it was just an old school model that you know would have rejected you either. And then finally, you have no idea what data was used, etc. Right? Part of the problem has nothing to do with the software that Terraria is building. It is actually about organizations, whether it's banks or fintechs or insurers, recognizing the importance of this kind of transparency. It's not about the AI. It's just about nobody likes to be told you have been rejected without being told why. Right? Doesn't matter if yep. it's a human or a machine or some combination.
I have a lot of experience with this. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. And I think the next part then is, okay, if that lack of transparency is coming because the bank in this instance was using a complex machine learning model, so not a linear regression kind of model, but a more complex model, then Terraria absolutely helps. And that is where we come in. What we do is we are able to help organizations understand what's happening inside their machine learning black box. We use techniques that were developed at Carnegie Mellon University over a 6-7 year period by two of our co-founders. well recognized in the industry. And what it would do in your instance is it would say, hey, these are the factors that actually pushed us to put on the negative side in terms of going against the decision. By the way, these other factors were working in your favor, but these factors kind of pushed it back. And this is obviously an audio podcast, but if I had a screen, I could have shown you what, some of the things that our clients are doing kind of in terms of visualizing that. So that's one thing we can do. But it's ultimately our software is not the customer-facing software. That's an internally focused software that is telling the bank what it is. Now, the bank could then choose to show you in real time, perhaps, a version of that if they're confident enough. But that's what we try and do. And that's what our clients use us for. And that's now, we use it not just to explain what you underwent, which is why didn't you get the loan, but we can also use it to explain other things, like why did you get the loan and not get the increase, whereas your wife got it, which is kind of some of the considerations around bias, which I'm sure we'll come into later. It's not just why you in absolute terms didn't get it, but also why you compared to another, or why your group compared to another group, or you compared to someone else didn't get it. Now, some of that might not be available to you because it might impinge on somebody else's privacy. But from a bank perspective, they should be able to answer all of those questions. And that's what our software enables.
You also are able to essentially understand the biases that the algorithms have, especially with underwriting. Have you seen that deployed? And what was the outcome of that? Because I'm so curious about ways in which we can use technology to identify, say, maybe women drivers get a better rate than men, but why, and sort of understand how those demographic inputs can affect the outcome as well.
Yeah, so I think there's two parts to that question. One is, are we able to understand the extent of bias? So in this case, the extent to which women drivers are getting better rates than men. That we can do, but to be honest, you can do that. If you had the data, which I understand in the United States is not that easy to actually get the gender data in this instance. I mean, you can't actually always collect the protected group information. But if you were able to do that, you know, any bank or insurer could use Excel to calculate, right? You know, men, women approval rates. So that part is easy. The difficult part, as you rightly pointed out, is understanding what is driving the behavior in that. So I can give you some examples. So in one of our clients, women were getting marginally, not very highly, but about 15% less likely to be approved compared to men in one of the markets that they were in, which was in Asia. And you know, using our software, they were able to go deeper into what is driving that. And what they found was that actually the factor that was driving that behavior was the credit bureau information for that country. It was a relatively weak credit bureau and had 9 men for every woman in the credit bureau. That's number one. But number two, guess who got into those, which women got into the credit bureau? Because it was historically weak, there was a bit of adverse selection with like the women who had credit history problems were the ones who were in the bureau. So once they realized that, they either took that field off or actually they complemented it with some other information on the income, and that helped them get over that. That's just one example. There's many others like this that our clients have gone.
What can you do when you don't have good data? We mentioned just quickly about financial inclusion. So if you're going to bring more people, or if the financial institution you're working with wants to bring more people on board, can you like simulate some of that data? You mentioned, I think, alternative data sources. Are those good enough to compare with traditional data? Or how can you work with that on the financial inclusion side?
Sure. I'm going to start on a slightly lighter note. Before joining Truera, I was group chief data officer at a major bank. And in answer to your question, what can you do without good data? Absolutely nothing, right? I think that is at the core of a lot of all of this. So I'm skeptical about whether you can use synthetic data to actually build good models. I mean, I know there's views on this. I think you can use it to test and your models, stress tested, etc. But except for a very specific niche within machine learning, most machine learning models do need a lot of good data. The question is, what is a lot? And the question is, what is good? Now, to answer your question, particularly for financial inclusion, what can you do? Well, first of all, you can look at alternate data within your organization. What I mean by that is, I mean, for example, if you're looking at that credit card limit example, well, you're an existing customer of your bank, right? That means they have a lot of information, and perhaps the decisions in the past were based on a relatively simplistic model or a relatively narrow model. And now they could look at other aspects of your behavior. They could look at the wealth management accounts that you have. They could look at, you know, how many times has this customer had to be called by our collection agents to pay overdues, etc.
Now, or he's always on cannabis websites. Steve's case.
I'll get to that because that's external data. Now, the first part, I guess, is inside an organization. There's already a lot of data about without going into the cannabis website point, right? Just like I actually know a lot more about this customer if I cared to look inside my organization. And this is particularly helpful, for example, in anti-money laundering related areas, right? Where it's permitted, you can get a much better picture of your customer. And once you get a much better picture of your customer, for example, if you know that this is Shamik, yes, I know he's employed by Truera. Yes, I know Truera's headquarters is in Redwood City. So it's not so unusual that he's getting regular US dollar inputs into his account in Singapore. Then you don't need to stop my transactions and ask me as a human why that happened. So that's one block. The second block, to take your cannabis example, is indeed to tap external sources. I've got to be very careful here, of course, in terms of the legality of the data being used, not the legality of the cannabis buying, but the legality of the data being used, the legality of the ethics of the data being used. But assuming you get to that, and assuming you've done it with full transparency and in line with the ethical values of the organization, there's a host of alternative data that you can use. And we're not in that business, but there's companies that focus on that particular space. And where our role comes in these situations is when you are taking these kinds of alternate data, whether internal or external, you don't know where that data has been, so to say, right? It's coming in from third-party sources. You don't know if it is representative, whether it has a bias against women or for women or for a particular race. So what our software can help with is, once you build a preliminary version of a model like that using external data, we can quickly give you a health check saying, hey, looking at the data you've got, these aspects of the data might drive unusual behavior in a model. So almost like an advance warning with a very preliminary version of the model. But that's what we do. We don't provide the third-party data.
So I understand that you also said you are involved in industry in England. Of course, you mentioned that you're in Singapore now. Truera is in the US, and I'm assuming it has a lot of US banks. Do you see a global model emerging for use in this data and for the way in which AI is deployed in financial services, or is it still very atomized and localized and based on how local governments see this space going?
So I think the answer is slightly different depending on whether you're asking about the use of AI or the use of third-party data, which is often essential to use AI at scale. The former, there's increasing alignment across organizations. And yes, I helped write the regulatory guidelines here in Singapore. I am part of the Bank of England's AI Public-Private Forum, and I've also been involved together with my colleagues in the US in responding to the US regulators. They had a very significant request for information for the industry on this. And I think there's general consensus. There's a whole bunch of things that regulators are concerned about. I have to say, regulators around the world are very keen to encourage innovation using artificial intelligence because they see the real life problems that can be solved for customers, for competition, etc. But generally, they're concerned about a few things. They're concerned that customers don't have the kind of experience you did, which is being told, computer says no, but I can't tell you why. That's right. That kind of transparency, very critical. Fairness, we talked about. Issues around overfitting and instability, where the machine learns from too few data points and then extrapolate. So they want that to be addressed. And a lot of them make the point about don't just do all these cautious things at the start, but actually keep monitoring your models for good quality straight through, right? That part, they all have their different requirements. And by last count, I think there were more than 270 different regulatory guidelines around the world on AI. But if you go into them, for the most part, there's a few common themes. I see the use of third-party data, though, which is a complement to the AI machine learning discussion, that is far more fragmented. And what is acceptable in one country is completely unacceptable in another. We just discussed some time ago, you know, in the United States, in many areas, you can't even collect whether somebody is a man or a woman. So how do you even decide whether there is bias? That's very different from say Singapore, where, you know, of course you can collect it. My race is collected and this is available to the bank. And that's part of the national conversation. It's not a good or bad thing. And it's relevant in Singapore because of historical reasons. In India, where I'm physically right now, there's a whole set of fintechs that collect far more information. So that area, which is what data can be collected and how good are the safeguards around using that data, that can be much more fragmented and localized. But the governance of AI, I think people are broadly coming around to a common set of considerations.
So I see once in a while the AI regulation comes up in Congress in proposed bills. What do you see down the line for regulation in the US?
Yeah, I can certainly speak to the financial sector, which is the one that I've been closely involved in. So I think there is first of all, there's a very good understanding of the issue. So the regulators are not operating in, well, this is a new thing we got to figure out. I mean, they've been very deliberate about it. Even in my previous role as part of the bank, I've been speaking to US regulators as part of industry bodies, etc. So the first thing is, this is a very deliberate, well thought through intervention. This is not a brash, you know, we need to get rid of new things kind of conversation. So that's the first thing. Second thing is, there's a lot of industry consultation available, involved. In particular, five agencies, I think the OCC, the Fed, the CFPB, and the credit union one, and one more I've forgotten just now. They got together for a massive consultation exercise in March, and they gave the industry 4 months, I think, in the end to react. And they took all the inputs in. What do I see happening, both in the US and elsewhere? It's interesting. I mean, one school of thought says AI is posing so many new risks that you should have new regulation. But another school of thought, and I certainly sit in the second one, is that you actually don't need new regulation. There's a whole bunch of things around model risk management, around data privacy, data management, et cetera, around equality, equal opportunity, around customer transparency, that basically just needs to be updated for the AI world. I mean, the example you gave at the start about your bank not telling you why they denied your increase in credit limit, you know, that could have been equally for a human situation or a non-AI algorithm. So I certainly am of the view that regulators are likely to look at what can be done to strengthen the existing regulatory framework in order to meet the requirements of AI, so specific quirks, whether it's the lack of transparency or the tendency to accentuate fairness issues, etc., rather than propose brand new regulation. But that's my preference and also my prediction. Of course, we'll have to see how different regulators react.
Politically, they might want to just see something that says AI regulation, just so people can say they've done something. There's a little bit of that too, I think.
Yeah, potentially. And there are certain areas which are certainly new, right? So, for example, in the European Union, there is a draft AI law that came in, not specific to financial services, in April. And it's quite interesting. The parts which are, you're right, I mean, having the draft AI law is like a signpost out there, which has kind of got everybody very keen to say what is in it. But there are parts of that which are unique to that draft law, such as the banning of AI in certain specific situations, like influencing vulnerable people, etc. And also the classification of 10 areas as high-risk use cases, of which one, by the way, is credit, another is recruitment. So that is new in that draft law. But then if you double-click on that and say, okay, you're giving credit and you're using AI, how are you going to demonstrate compliance to this law? It actually just points you to the banking regulation. Similarly, you know, if it's about embedded AI embedded in machinery, such as, let's say, elevators or heavy or medical equipment, they just point you to the existing regulations around medical equipment and elevators. So I think you are right. There is certainly a desire to make it clear that there are certain red lines and there's certain there's a level of positioning around AI regulation that is essential. But if you go with the EU experience, I think what might happen is there's a level of headline. Here's the AI related regulation. Here's what it covers and some things that are new. And then a level of cross-reference back to say, oh, by the way, if you want to do this safely, you should go back to, I don't know, in the case of banking, use the model risk management SR11-7 guidelines, for example.
Right, right. Yeah, there's a lot of existing work on model risk for long term.
Yeah. And in the US, for example, Equal Opportunities Act, et cetera, that already covers. I mean, you don't need a new AI law to complain if you are discriminated against, as an example, right? You can absolutely do that today. Yeah,
but we do anyway. yes. We complain anyway. If you knew Steve, you'd know why not to lend him money is a good idea.
That's a secret, John. Simple. Come on.
He knows why.
That is unethical. That sounds like unethical use of confidential data to me, which you have access to. So I shall not probe that part.
So you were at a large bank for a long time. I don't know if you mind saying Standard Chartered.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so you saw a lot of different things, a very different experience from going to True Era. Is it fair to call True Era still a startup, or have they been up and around for a while? Yeah.
I mean, I think they were in stealth mode for a while, but I think the time since Series A is probably just over a year, year and a half. So yeah, it is still a startup. Yeah.
Okay.
Yes, it is a very different experience. It's been very different. What's been fantastic is, well, first of all, maybe just to step back, it wasn't a big shift in my area of focus, because even at Standard Chartered Bank, I was Group Chief Data Officer. And so any of the stuff going wrong that we just discussed would have come to me. And also Standard Chartered Bank is a UK regulated bank. And in the UK, there's this thing called the Banking Reform Act, which basically meant I was governed in my role by the UK regulator, which is the FCA, right? So a lot of these responsibilities around ensuring data quality, data ethics, algorithmic transparency, et cetera, was mine anyway. So to some extent, in terms of the area I'm working in, it's not very different from what I was doing. It's just I'm able to go much deeper into this, and I'm able to look at this not just from a Standard Chartered example perspective, but across, as I mentioned, more than 50 organizations already in terms of client. So that's the content answer. I think in terms of how it feels to be, if you have bankers as part of your attendance on the podcast, ex-bankers, I would say what I really like is the freedom to focus on the thing that I'm really interested in right now, which was this. So it's a relatively focused piece of software, and it's an area that I know, and it's an area that I want to grow in further, and I'm able to do that. That ability to focus is amazing, right? That's first. And the second is, of course, Standard Chartered had, I think it has 85,000 people. I had 2,500 people in my team. I'm now part of a 35-member startup, and my title is grandly head of financial services, but that head is me.
Wow, you're a big deal. Stuff.
Yeah, right. It's like all of me compared to, you know, the 2,000 plus people I had. Actually, that's been amazingly, after 2 decades in the industry, that's amazingly refreshing, because you're... Yeah, liberating. Exactly. That's the right word. Because you're kind of doing stuff, you know. I mentioned earlier, I run a small podcast. I said, oh, I want to do a podcast. And the reaction was, yeah, go ahead, find a recording studio, figure out your guests, do it. There was no, bureaucracy, if you will, but equally, there was no support system. It's like, you find it and you go and do it. So I really like that aspect. And then finally, you know, for any ex-bankers who've not been in client-facing roles like me, I was in data, technology, et cetera. I also find it really interesting to see, you know, it's very good of me to talk at regulatory forums about pontificate about what it should be. But when you're in front of somebody who has to pay money for your software, you need to really make it relevant to them and to their customers. So I like that challenge that comes from being customer-facing, at least in terms of these senior conversations with banks, insurers, and fintechs.
So we're getting the honest feedback now.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, on that point, I would say, just in the spirit of honesty, I said I like that, but in all of those three things, not maybe the part about the freedom to focus, but the other pieces, you know, the freedom to do things by yourself and the freedom and the experience of working with customers. It's good, of course, but it's also a big challenge, you know. 2 decades in a bank or in consulting, and then more than a decade in a bank. And then suddenly you're asked to do. It's been a massive learning exercise, and there have been mistakes along the way. In the spirit of honesty, I'll say that. I also say that because if somebody is listening, thinking about a move themselves from a large institution into a fintech or a startup, be prepared to unlearn as much as to learn, is what I would say.
All right, make the big jump. Shamik's giving you the green light. Yeah, go for it.
Yes.
Yeah, you know, it's, I know there's typically there's a big cultural change, and I've been in both worlds, or starting in the,
yes,
the startup or venture-backed companies first. And we used to joke at the small companies how there would be so much bureaucracy and paperwork and changes and the org restructures and all that. And we can just talk to marketing people and spitball ideas and make them happen, go out and get the software or start implementing. That change is but you seem very realistic about it. So, open to learning is a big part of that.
And unlearning. And in 2 decades, can embed certain behaviors in anybody. So you have to be willing to drop that outside the door.
People tell me I'm very good at the unlearning part. Yeah. They're very honest with me about that. Yeah. So what's next for True Era? You guys are small. What would you like to see True Era become or do in the next 2 or 3 years or so?
So if you look at True Era's founders, as well as kind of many of the founding engineers, or even some of the very recent engineers joining us from the likes of MIT, etc., there's a unifying thread. I think there's a level of passion about, there's a belief in the power of machine learning coupled with frustration. Particularly some of these are the ex-data scientists, at how difficult it is to do it well, right? So I know it'll sound grand, but really we'd like to make machine learning successful. Our success will come from the use of AI and machine learning becoming, at scale, really becoming common. And if I look at the financial services industry, one that I know well, there is just so much you can do, right? The hype is real if you actually follow through, and the opportunities are really amazing, whether it's financial inclusion or much better customer experience or dealing with new kinds of insurance that didn't even exist. The opportunities are immense, but they will remain on paper unless we crack this problem on how to make AI and machine learning trustworthy, and how to make the life of data scientists as they go about building models much easier in terms of, because before it goes to a regulator or anybody else, the data scientists themselves, they don't want to build models that are biased or that are difficult to understand, etc. So giving them the tools to help do a much better job, which in turn allows, machine learning to play a much bigger role in the core business proposition. That is our mission. And what does that mean on the ground? I think you're going to see us, do much more in terms of our software becoming much better at supporting the data scientists as well as the business stakeholders. I think we have some skew there right now, so we'll get much more across the full life cycle. That's one aspect. I think the second thing is we really recognize the linkage between models and data. So how we can take the insights we've got from our model management software or model quality software and translate that into data implications, that's going to be a big one. And then most importantly, we're hoping to have more and more clients across many different industries. Certainly financial services will be a big one. That itself, I think, will drive a lot of the growth. And we're super excited because I think it goes back to what I started this answer with. There's a sense of mission around, there's a huge potential here which lies untapped, and our mission is to help get that potential realized.
Good luck with that. It sounds like an awesome mission and something where it's a good business because you see that there's a gap there, there's a need.
Yeah, it comes from a position of kind of having felt that pain. Many of us, co-founders have been in Google building their AI platform. Our head of engineering is from Visa. I'm from a major bank. And all of us have seen, many of our more junior data, folks have been in positions where they've been frustrated with the lack of tooling for this. So it comes from a position of being through the pain, and we know the pain points we're trying to solve, and we think those are very real. And we hope to make a difference there.
Yeah. Well, good luck to you on that. And we'll talk about getting around the financial crime detection offline. But sure. Keep up the good work. And thanks for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
That's Shamik Kundu, the head of financial services at True Era, trueera.com. Please hit subscribe to keep up with the latest in fintech news. And thank you for listening.